Great to be back with you. I was here, I think it's about 4 years ago, and see a lot of faces. I had a little trouble connecting names and faces, but I just love this church. I love being here, and Mike and I have become very close friends over the years. He's a thinker, as a teacher and a people person, and he loves this church, and he loves you people. He's been a real challenge to my heart. We're going to talk about some pretty interesting things this week, things I've been thinking about for a number of years and finally decided I'm going to try to pull this together. You guys are going to kind of be guinea pigs here on first time out, so we'll see how this goes. I want to start with something that goes on in our marriage. I've got a fabulous wife. She's extremely big on special days, you know, like anniversaries, birthdays, whatnot. I learned that the first year we were married when I missed Valentine's Day. And true to form, a number of years ago, she bought me a cruise, a Scientific American cruise on cosmology. It was a cruise of the Caribbean. And we went down and I think it was about a week or 8 days, as I recall. It was a fabulous time. And we stopped at a couple of islands. I remember one of them was St. Thomas. And, of course, Linda took off to do some retail therapy. And and I was with a bunch of fellow geeks and nerds. There's about 2,000-3,000 people on this boat. And there was a couple of things that were really good, but I was there to listen to a series of special lectures on cosmology, pay a little bit extra, and they had all these, these guys here were all there. They were practicing scientists, engineers, professors at universities, and me. And most of these guys, probably all of them, were pretty secular. And I wasn't there to argue, but I was there to learn. I wanted to know, hear it from the horse's mouth, how the universe came into existence. And I'd read a lot of books, so I had a general idea, but I thought it would be good to get an update. So every morning, I would get up and go to these special lectures for a couple hours. And it was very, very fantastic. I just really learned a lot. These guys were extremely secular. I think, a number of them were atheists. Now, I remember the guy that started it. He was a guy by the name of Lawrence Krauss. He came up and he gave the first lecture. And Krauss started out by saying that his purpose for the week was to convince us that the universe was absolutely pointless. So I thought after that opening salvo, I was going to be in for a pretty interesting week, and I was. And I was firsthand exposed to the utter hopelessness and the meaninglessness of life that emerges out of scientific naturalism. And Krauss, of course, epitomized this. I was reading a book by Steven Weinberg. He was a Nobel laureate, one of the architects of the Big Bang Theory, which we'll talk very briefly about this evening. And Weinberg says, the more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems pointless. What solace does he offer? What's the solution? He says, the effort to understand the universe is one of the very few things that lifts human life a little above the level of farce. Get that? In other words, if you want to get your life better than farce, you've got to make an effort to understand the universe. And gives it some of the grace of tragedy. Now, one can sympathize with Weinberg and the dilemma that he's in, since he's committed to atheistic materialism, scientific materialism. And we can also appreciate his honesty, because on his materialistic presuppositions, not much more can be said. We're in an era where a number of basic questions continually crop up in the philosophy texts and in university classrooms. It's the question of how did it all begin? That's what we're going to talk about tonight. Then what went wrong? The human existence is an existence of unbelievable suffering and horror worldwide. So that's going to chart our journey over the next couple of days. But modern man is in a state of, despair for a number of reasons. First of all, in the 16th century, men believed that the universe was around the earth. In other words, the earth was at the center. The church taught that. The science of Aristotelian physics taught that. And that gave man a sense of importance, that he was unique, that we were distinct in some way. But Copernicus worked out a better solution to the physics and the math and showed that the sun, instead of revolving around the earth was revolving around the sun, and the sun was at the center, not us, of the solar system. So we were moved away a little bit from the centrality. And then the vastness of the universe came upon us in the 1920s, where they discovered that we were not just insignificant, but vastly insignificant. We're part of one galaxy, Edwin Hubble discovered, and we're not even at the center of that galaxy. We're about two-thirds of the way out toward the rim. And furthermore, we found out that we are one galaxy in the midst of billions and billions of galaxies. So the very vastness of the universe began to move us more and more from the center of attention. Carl Sagan wrote a book about this, and this is a shot of the Earth from the orbit of Neptune looking back. And it's just a little pale blue dot. And Sagan looks at this picture, and he says, our posturings, by the way, Carl Sagan was the professor of astrophysics at Cornell University, a very prominent scientist and spokesman for materialistic science. He says, our posturing, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe, are challenged by this point of pale light. That's here. That's us. That's home. That's our planet. It's a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. So Sagan is concerned about our arrogance. He is no longer full of self-importance or deluded. And he doesn't believe that we have a privileged position. Well, of course, the third thing that has reduced man's significance is the theory of evolution. We no longer need an explanation. A supernatural explanation is believed for the origin of life. It all happened by random chance processes. Random mutations operated on by natural selection over a billion years produced all the various biological complexity that we see. I was at a conference up in Denver a number of years ago of scientists, believing and unbelieving. Most of them were unbelieving professors in the area, and it was on the communication between evangelicals and the scientific community, and particularly the aspect of it that is skeptical. And I remember sitting in some small discussion groups, and we were talking about various evidences for evolution. And I sat there somewhat astounded at how thin the evidence was and how intelligent people could actually argue some of these things. That's not to say there aren't some plausible arguments. I'm not dismissing all of it. But I realized that if this is all they got, maybe it's not as certain as they say. And I remember talking to one guy in particular. He was quite agitated. Because I had said some things that weren't quite down the line. And I finally told him, I said, look, evolution is a fairy tale for grown-ups. And he was kind of shocked. And I started citing a number of things, and he had no idea. He'd never heard these things that would be contradictory to the theory. Well, scientists have established that the universe seems to have a beginning. And this was a troubling discovery, because that meant if it had a beginning, it had a beginner, or at least it suggested that. So I want to talk a bit about that. I used to be with Campus Crusade for Christ. And for 8 years, I was a campus evangelist. Loved going in and talking with college students. And I remember I came up with one student. He was a senior in mechanical engineering. And we got into a nice little conversation. And he said he didn't believe, you know, in the Bible. And said there's absolutely no evidence for creation. And I said, well, actually, there is. I think I can prove it to you. Now, of course, I can't, but I thought I'd generate a little pushback. And he said, oh, you can't prove that. And I said, well, yeah. And he said, well, show me. So I said, now, you're a junior in mechanical engineering, right? And he said, yeah. And I said, are you familiar with the first and second laws of thermodynamics? Oh, yeah, sure. We study that all the time. Now, for those of you that aren't, let me explain it briefly. The first law says that energy cannot be created or destroyed. This is kind of a fundamental principle of science. In other words, any exchange of energy, it's always got to be conserved. You don't have more or less after it's been used. So you've got a total amount of energy is constant. And that total amount of energy is the free energy plus the free energy, the energy available for work and the free energy that's just floating around. Don't worry about all the terms if you don't get it. The diagram, I think, will make the point. But the second law says that the total energy available for accomplishing work is declining. Now, there's a lot of kind of simplistic ways I could explain this. This morning I had some food, and then I just had a great dinner over at Henry's, and there's a lot of calories in there. And as a result of those calories, there's some energy. So I helped pull this thing. Now, when I just did that, there was friction between this and the floor, generated a little bit of heat. And some of those calories I ate were just turned into heat and radiated up in the atmosphere. Believe it or not, that's what happened. Well, all the second law says is that you can never recapture all of that energy, shove it back into the system, and move things back. That energy available for accomplishing work is gone. Well, the problem is that these curves intersect at a point. You could never have more energy available to do work than you had total energy. So there had to be a starting point. Everything to the left of that point is impossible. So you end up with a beginning point. Now, a lot of physicists are aware of this problem. Stephen Hawking talks about it. Here's one, Paul Davies, God in the New Physics. He makes the point, every day the universe becomes more and more disordered. Actually, the second law is also described as a law of disorder. In other words, it says that everything moves from order to disorder with the passage of time. I've lost some hair. My automobile rusts. We all know everything goes downhill the older we get. Every day, the universe becomes more and more disordered. If the universe has a finite stock of order, that would be the energy available to do work, the universe cannot have existed forever. Otherwise, it would have reached its equilibrium state an infinite time ago. So, when did it begin? Well, they say that it happened with a big bang. That's how the media describes it. Actually, it was more like the inflation of a balloon. And they believe that about 14 billion years ago, the universe popped into existence out of a primordial energy field, which they call vacuum energy or perhaps dark energy. And universes are popping into existence all the time. We're just one of them. And during the first it's a minuscule part of a second, the universe expanded at a speed thousands of times the speed of light. It's the only way they can get this math and physics to work out is to posit this. Now, there's no evidence for this inflation, at least no compelling evidence. And they have to make a lot of extra ad hoc assumptions to make the thing work. But that's the current theory, that space itself expanded and carried the universe with it. Now, where did that universe come from? Well, it came out of this field of dark energy, supposedly. But what happens here is that they don't want anything prior existence. So this is Lawrence Krauss again, the guy that opened up the discussion. He says, well, it came out of nothing. In fact, he wrote a book on it. I read it. It's a universe from nothing. And, well, I thought there was something. But he says, well, actually, no. So he starts examining the meaning of the word nothing. Now, you and I would have thought, well, yeah, we know what nothing is. Not a zip, zero, no energy, nothing. Not so. He says that the universe was permeated by an energy field of vacuum energy. And that, without getting into the weeds on it, that various universes pop like bubbles out of a foam. And we're just one of them. So that's what he's reduced to. Then, of course, you ask, well, where did the energy field come from? Well, he doesn't know, but obviously it was not nothing. And yet he wrote a whole book on this. For the scientist, this creates a problem because it suggests that the universe came into existence out of nothing, really not a zip nothing. And that implies some cause that brought it into existence. This is Robert Jastrow, a very prominent secular astronomer. For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. And as he pulls himself over the final rock, he's greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. In other words, God is a plausible explanation of this. Well, what I'd like to point to
scientists have determined the relative strengths of each of these primary laws and forces.
Some of the,
these strengths are so critically balanced.
Whoa, that wasn't supposed to
they
start
are often
yet,
described as.
The universe gives evidence that it was designed. We want to talk about some of these evidences, and it's not. It's secular scientists that are calling attention to this, including atheistic scientists, because it's really created a kind of conundrum for them. Because the evidence for design, if it is designed, it seems to imply the existence of a designer.
During the past 40 years, scientists have determined the relative strengths of each of these primary laws and forces. These strengths are so critically balanced, they are often described as being finely tuned.
If you're to take the basic fundamental constants of nature and you were to change these even slightly, or you were to pick their values at random, you would almost never get a universe that would be habitable in any sort of way. That is, you couldn't have galaxies, you couldn't have planets, you couldn't have complex biological organisms if these fundamental constants were even slightly different, slightly stronger, slightly weaker than they actually are in this universe. That's the idea of fine-tuning.
Okay, I'm not going to explain what all these means. I just want to highlight five of about 35 of these fundamental constants of nature. First of all, in order for the Big Bang theory to work, the universe had to expand at a certain rate, and it had to be precise within one part in 10 to the 120th. That means 1 in 10 with 120 zeros after it. And if it varied just one part in that, the universe would either explode or it would condense and collapse, and life wouldn't be here. Now, this is probably the greatest contradiction between the prediction from a theory of inflation and observation. In fact, the scientists are very puzzled by this because it indicates an extreme degree of specific fine-tuning in order to make life possible. The gravitational constant, you're all familiar with that. That's what because of that, we weigh ourselves every morning on the scale. And if that varied by more than 2%, you and I wouldn't be here. This is the kind of fine-tuning that I'm suggesting. The strong force is the force that holds protons and neutrons together in the nucleus of an atom. And apparently, if this varied by 0.5% in ratio to the electric force, by 4%, we wouldn't exist. Now, fine-tuning implies that there is someone to do the tuning. Excuse me here. Anthony Flew was an atheistic philosopher. He wrote a number of books. I remember when I was working with college kids back in the 60s. He was kind of the arch-atheist that everybody, from a Christian perspective, was talking about. And, of course, he had convinced a lot of college students. And he wrote a book in the 60s that a lot of us read entitled There Is No God. And it was his proof that God did not exist. But something strange happened in 2006. Flew, while studying the cells and the enormous amount of specific information encoded in the DNA of our cell structure, concluded that only an intelligence could put there. It's a four-letter language, and it contains enough information to fill a 20-volume set of encyclopedias. Now, information is an indication of intelligence. So Flew looked at that and said, there must be a God. Now, to my knowledge, he didn't become a Christian, but he wrote a book called There Is a God, because he changed his mind. He was honest when he saw the data. And he gives this illustration. He says, suppose you went on a vacation to Hawaii. You and your wife are excited to get this time away, and you walk into the hotel room, and a CD player is playing, and it's got your favorite singer or band playing. So you say, oh, well, that's kind of interesting. And you go a little bit further, and you look on the mantle, and there's a picture over it that's exactly the same as the picture in your home. And you look at the coffee table beside the couch. Sure enough, there's a book there by your favorite author, Robert Ludlum. And you turn on TV, and it's tuned to your favorite channel, of course, Fox News, right? And you're beginning to get a little suspicious of what's going on here. So you go into the bathroom, and you see that all the shaving implements, it's got that purple stuff, gel, Gillette, it's got Colgate toothpaste, it's got Right Guard, exact stuff that you use. Now, the last thing you would think is that this was by accident. And the more the evidence stacked up, you would say to yourself, somebody knew we were coming. Now that's the fine-tuning argument. The entire universe is tuned for life. Somebody knew we were coming. Now, to date, 35 parameters. You know, I mentioned strong force. We've talked about the force of gravity, we've talked about the rate of expansion, but we've got the gas constant, Planck's constant, 34 fundamental constants of nature. And each of these parameters, all 35 of them, has to be tuned just right. It can't vary with 0.1% in some cases, or 1 or 2 in others, or we wouldn't be here. Now, the probability has been calculated by Hugh Ross. He's an astrophysicist formerly at Caltech. He now has an actual ministry, Reasons to Believe. And he worked out the probabilities that all 35, by random chance processes, could be put together to reflect or describe the universe that we are in. And he says it's one chance in 10 to the 53rd. That is 10 followed by 53 zeros. This is the problem scientific materialism has with some of these recent discoveries of fine-tuning that they have to deal with. I read a great book by Mikio Kaku. He is an astrophysicist. I think he was at Syracuse University. I can't remember right now. And he says, all this fine-tuning makes us realize that a miraculous set of accidents makes consciousness possible in this three-dimensional universe of ours. There is a ridiculously narrow band of parameters that makes intelligent life a reality. And we happen to live in just that band. I'm quoting these guys because they're not believers. One can debate whether this fortuitous circumstance is one of design or accident. But no one can dispute the intricate tuning necessary to make us possible. You've all heard, or maybe you have, most of you probably have, of Stephen Hawking. He's probably the most eminent scientist of the 20th century, perhaps since Einstein. He's been responsible for the theories about black holes and the structure of the fundamental structure of the universe. And Brief History of Time was a book he wrote a number of years ago. It's probably the most purchased and unread book in the history of publishing. It's on everybody's coffee table to show that they have read. Actually, it's not that hard to read. It's brief, and he does a good job of explaining things. But in that book, he works through alternative explanations that don't require God as an explanation. But he finally says this: the odds against a universe like ours emerging out of something like the Big Bang is enormous. I think there are clearly religious explanations. Every 3 or 4 years, Linda and I go to Cambridge, England, and I get to spend about 4 or 6 weeks in nerd heaven at the Tyndale House, which is one of the best biblical studies libraries in the world. It's right on the campus there, just on the edge of the campus. And Hawking's Institute is 2 blocks away. And I tried to get an appointment with him, but I figured he didn't want to talk to little old me. But I did meet one of his first assistant. He's a believer, and he's going to the church that we were going to in Cambridge during those 6 weeks. And I had just read Hawking's latest book. It's an update on Brief History of Time. And I was reading through this, and I just thought, boy, there's a lot of speculation here. But I wondered, well, you know, Hawking's a whole lot smarter than I am, and he knows a whole lot more facts than I do, so maybe there's something, I don't know. So I went and I talked to his assistant, who's a PhD in astrophysics, works with him in research. And I said, it seemed to me this was, there was an awful lot of just rank speculation in this. He said, Jody, it's all speculation. And that was kind of assuring, obviously. But he was totally informed, obviously worked with Stephen. Stephen is actually a great human being. He had Lou Gehrig's disease, they call it in the States. It's muscular, ALS, whatever. But anyway, all the muscles lose their ability to move. And he ended up in a wheelchair. He lived with it for 50 years. No one's ever done that before. He's kind of a miracle, really. Both of his wives were believers. They used to talk to him and drag him to church periodically. But at the end of life, he still didn't believe. Fred Hoyle is a very prominent scientist. He died about 15 years ago. And he's looking at the facts that we've talked about. And he says, a common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a superintendent has monkeyed with the physics. Now, Hoyle's not a believer. He's just laid it out what this evidence points toward. He says, I do not believe that any physicist who examined the evidence could fail to draw the inference that the laws of nuclear physics have been deliberately designed with regard to the consequences they produce within the stars. And he goes on to talk about the necessity of life. I'm a Trekkie. Now, that means I watch Star Trek. Now, don't psychoanalyze me. I just like it. And I liked the original series the best. But in the second one, Star Trek The Next Generation, the crew of the Starship Enterprise, which goes places where no man has ever gone before. They're out in the distant parts of the universe, and they run into a race of super beings called the Q. Now, the Q claim to have an IQ of 2005. They have developed the ability of energy transformation. They can point to one of you and raise you up off the ground. They can move you through time. They've learned the secret of time travel. These are pretty bright folks, and they live in the Q continuum. Now, in this imaginary story, Q takes the captain of the Starship Enterprise back to the beginning of time. And on arrival, he took Captain Jean-Luc Picard. By the way, for those of you that are Trekkies, this was on Stardate 3464, just in case you wanted to. And they took him into this room, and there was this giant machine there. And it's got all these terms like mass density, weak nuclear force, strong nuclear force, speed of light, etc. It's got all these dials. Well, you ask the Q, well, what's this machine for? And after a few snide remarks denigrating human intelligence, the Q says, well, this is a universe-creating machine. Oh. So according to the Q, the great race of the Q used it to create the universe in which they live in, and the existing universe in which all of us dumb humans live in. Seems that the Q are the creators of everything. Oh. So he explains that the dials on this machine have to be set extremely precisely in order for a universe to pop out. And what you can do is you can punch the numbers in on the left, or you can just turn the dials and the numbers will appear. Then you push the button, and the universe, determined by how you set things, will pop into existence. But before it does, you get a preview screen. Now, the Q tells Captain Picard, you know, these numbers have to be set just right, because if it's not set just right, all you're going to get is junk and not a real viable universe in which people can live. So you ask, well, how precisely do these dials have to be set? Well, the Q responds saying they've only found one possible combination that produces a universe even mildly habitable, the one we're in. What's the number at the top of the pad up there? It starts with 9348. Well, the Q says, well, that's the grand unified combination. That's the combination that will produce a universe in which is habitable. It's only one number. So you ask, do you mean there's only two habitable universes? The one the Q live in and ours that the Q created? Well, no, says the Q. Really, there's only one. Now you're getting suspicious. There's only one combination of dials that must be set on the universe creating machine to produce our universe. Well, then, how did you set them when the universe you live in hadn't been created yet? By what magic did you create a universe which you yourselves live in? Well, the cue was getting aware that your baloney detector was setting off alarms. So they said, well, we didn't actually find the right combination ourselves. In fact, the machine doesn't belong to us. We merely found it with the dials already set. The machine had done its work before we arrived. Ever since then, we've been looking for another set of dial combinations to create another habitable universe. But alas, we've not found one. However, like Hawking, we are certain that other universes exist. Well, we'll just have to keep looking. Now, this illustrates one of the discoveries that I'm trying to highlight here. Fine-tuning. There's only one combination that works, and we're in it. So like the visitor in the Hawaiian hotel room, it seems that somebody knew we were coming. Well, how do the materialists respond to this evidence? Obviously, they must have answers because they don't believe that this requires God. Some of you probably have heard the name Richard Dawkins. He's probably the most prominent, or one of the most prominent atheistic philosophers of our era. He's written a number of books very hostile to biblical Christianity and the whole idea about God. Been in a lot of debates around the country with creationists. And here's his explanation. It's called panspermia.
Lorraine, who did create the heavens and the earth?
Why do you use the word who? You see, you immediately beg the question by using the word who.
Well, then how did it get created?
Well, by a very slow process.
Well, how did it start?
Nobody knows how it got started. We know the kind of event that it must have been. We know the sort of event that must have happened for the origin of life.
What was that?
It was the origin of the first self-replicating molecule.
Right, how did that happen?
I told you, we don't know.
So you have no idea how it started?
No, nor has anybody.
Nor has anyone else. What do you think is the possibility that that intelligent design might turn out to be the answer to some issues in genetics or in evolution?
It could come about in the following way. It could be that at some earlier time, somewhere in the universe, a civilization evolved by probably some kind of Darwinian means to a very, very high level of technology and designed a form of life that they seeded onto perhaps this planet. Now, that is a possibility and an intriguing possibility. Mm. And I suppose it's possible that you might find evidence for that if you look at the details of biochemistry, molecular biology, you might find a signature of some sort of designer.
Wait a second. Richard Dawkins thought intelligent design might be a legitimate pursuit?
And that designer could well be a higher intelligence from elsewhere in the universe. Well, but that higher intelligence would itself have had to have come about by some explicable or ultimately explicable process. It couldn't have just jumped into existence spontaneously. That's the point.
So Professor Dawkins was not against intelligent design, just certain types of designers, such as God. So the Hebrew God, the God of the Old Testament, he doesn't exist in your view?
Certainly. I mean, that would be a very unpleasant prospect.
And Holy Trinity of the New Testament?
Nothing like that.
Do you believe in any of the Hindu gods? Like Vishnu?
How can you ask such a question?
You don't, right?
How could I? Why would I, given that I don't believe in any others?
You don't believe in the Muslim God?
No. Why do you even need to ask?
Well, I just wanted to be sure. So you don't believe in any God anywhere?
Any God anywhere would be completely incompatible with anything that I've said.
I just wanted to make sure. You don't believe in any God anywhere?
No.
What if after you died, you ran into God? He said, what have you been doing, Richard? I mean, what have you been doing? I've been trying to be nice to you. Yeah. I gave you a multi-million dollar paycheck over and over again with your book, and look what you did.
Bertrand Russell had that point put to him, and he said something like, sir, why did you take such pains to hide yourself?
But if the intelligent design people are right, God isn't hidden. We may even be able to encounter God through science, if we have the freedom to go there. What could be more intriguing than that?
We take freedom for granted here in the United States. Freedom is what this country is all about.
Okay, notice what he's saying, that life started on Earth, it came on the heel of an astronaut's boot. In other words, ancient aliens brought it. Now, this is a top scientist, and it falls into the ABG category, anything but God. This is the kind of thing that they are coming up with because they have no explanation. A naturalistic explanation for this evidence. There's another option. I've already alluded to it. It's the multiverse. Okay, it's highly improbable, one chance in 10 followed by 53 zeros, that all of these universes, all these constants could occur randomly that apparently are necessary for life to exist. That's probability of zero. Well, the answer to it, in Stephen Hawking's view, is that we're just one universe of 10 to the 500 universes. That's 10 with 500 zeros after it. And surely, Hawking says, if you've got that many universes popping into existence out of this vacuum energy. He never explains where the vacuum energy came from. One of them would have the right combination of constants. That's the idea. Now, just a second here. Here's Hawking.
You say that science can explain the universe without the need for a creator.
Larry King.
But what is that explanation? Why is there something instead of nothing?
Gravity and quantum theory cause universes to be created spontaneously out of nothing.
You write that because there is a law such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Will you tell me how that law came into existence?
Gravity is a consequence of M theory, which is the only possible unified theory. It is like saying, why is 2 + 2 = 4?
I guess simply put, do you believe in God?
God may exist, but science can explain the universe without the need for a creator.
Why do you think people react so strongly to your contention that it's not necessary to invoke God to explain the creation of the universe?
Science is increasingly answering questions that used to be the province of religion.
Okay, now I realize.
One of your colleagues at Cambridge says that science provides us with a narrative as to how existence may happen, but theology addresses the meaning of the narrative. How do you respond to that?
The scientific account is complete. Theology is unnecessary.
Okay, let's look at this in more detail. Larry asks, why is there something rather than nothing? Hawking answers, gravity and quantum theory caused the universe to be created spontaneously out of nothing. Now, this is 100% speculation, and we'll come to the other comments on this by other scientists in a moment, but it's purely a manufactured mathematical idea that has never been experimentally observed. So, King says, you write that because there is a law such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Can you tell me how that law came into existence? Well, gravity is the consequence of M theory, which is the only possible unified theory. It's like saying, how is 2 plus 2 equal 4? Now, M theory is a version of so-called string theory. I better not get into that. But the idea is it's a mathematical concept. They're looking for one equation that will unify all the forces of nature into one or two equations. And they find mathematically they've worked out something called M theory that does some of that. So that's the only possible alternative explanation. Do you believe in God? God may exist, but science can explain the universe without need for a creator. Now, see, this reveals the fundamental premise behind all of these things. Over the centuries, whenever the Christians ran into something they couldn't explain, say gravity or rain, some simple things, they tended to describe God to be the cause. But as science moved on, they found out, well, it wasn't God that caused rain. It's the recycling of water from the surface evaporation gets into clouds and condenses. Then they found that gravity was a force property of mass with Isaac Newton. So the point is that all these Christians are saying, well, God did it, God did it, God did it. And science keeps finding explanations for how it wasn't God. Therefore, that means that science one day will find an explanation for this. You see, you Christians just plug in God anytime you can't explain something. And that's the end of physics. No point in doing research if God did it. A very prominent geneticist said regarding the theory of evolution, he said that the only, I think I'm quoting accurately here, the only alternative to evolution is special creation, which is unthinkable. See, they're committed to this ideology that requires an explanation that is completely naturalistic. It's scientific naturalism that has to drive everything. Why do you think people react so intensely to your contention that it is not necessary to invoke God to explain the creation of the universe? Then he answers basically along the lines I just described. Science is increasingly answering questions that used to be the province of religion. Therefore, we'll answer this one too. So instead of plugging God in the gaps, they plug speculative theories. And again, this multiverse theory, it falls in the category of A, B, G. Anything but God. Now, why is it that intelligent, good men, like these men I've been quoting, can look at the universe and not see what it's begging them to see? There's a story about Sherlock Holmes and his faithful companion, Dr. Watson. They went on a camping trip. and they got a bottle of wine, had a good dinner, retired for the night. They went to sleep. But some hours later, Holmes wakes up in the middle of the night Watson, look up at the sky. Tell me what you see. I see millions and millions of stars, Holmes, Watson replies. And what do you deduce from that? Watson ponders for a moment. And he says, well, astronomically, it tells me that there are millions of galaxies and potentially billions of stars. Astrologically, I observe that Saturn is in Leo. Horologically, I deduce that the time is approximately 3:15. Meteorologically, I suspect that we will have a beautiful day tomorrow. Holmes is silent for a moment, and he replies, Watson, you idiot, somebody stole our tent. Now, the point of this is that many modern scientists, like Watson, they can see the details, but they reject what the details of fine-tuning are begging them to see. They cannot see. But the reason they cannot see is because they choose not to. You know, the scriptures comment on this. In Romans 1:17, Paul says that the reason they don't see it is because they don't want to. He says, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Now, of course, the tendency to suppress truth is everywhere present in Western culture. Furthermore, Paul says that the evidence for theism is so clear that to ignore it is not an intellectual issue, it's a moral one. He says in verses 19 to 20, because that which is known about God is evident within them, that is, your conscience is testifying to this. For God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power, and his divine nature have been clearly seen. That's some of these evidences that they're discovering now would be an example. Being understood through what has been made. So that, he says, they are without excuse. And instead of following the evidence, which Paul says is sufficient for open hearts, Paul says in verse 21, for even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became vain in their futile imaginations. And their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. Now, there's one final point I'd like to close on. We've talked about all these evidences for fine-tuning, but perhaps one of the most amazing is our galactic location. Let me explain what I mean. Where is the planet, our planet, located within the Milky Way galaxy? Well, it's located in towards the outer edge in the arms of the galaxy. And that is important because if it was closer to the center, it would be right in the midst of an enormous amount of cosmic radiation that would wipe out any kind of life instantly. But another interesting point, it's located in the outer spiral, most of which are full of dust, so you couldn't see anything. But our planet happens to be located in one particular area within this habitable zone where they can see and make scientific observations and observe the universe because the clouds are not in that area, the dust clouds are not in that area. Now, that location is ideal for discovery. Now, there's no obvious connection between the requirements for life, the fine-tuning of those 35 constants, and the ability to observe. And yet these two things converge. And why do they converge? What does this signify? Now imagine that you were... Okay, in Hawaii, they placed some telescopes on the top of a mountain there, two telescopes. Now, why did they place them there? Because that's the best place to see. And we are located in the best place to actually see what's out there. being habitable and being observable are distinct properties. Astronomers put telescopes where viewing conditions are best. Telescopes do not exist on mountaintops because of some blind chance. They are put there because that's the best place to observe the stars. Now, is this a coincidence that our planet just happens to be in the best place to observe God's glory and to make scientific observations which suggest fine-tuning? There's an astrophysicist, Guillermo Gonzalez. I read his book. He said, "This is like winning the lottery twice in a row, to find ourselves just where they can best make diverse discoveries is doubly telling. This is the sort of universe that an intelligent agent would have some interest in designing." So of all the places in the universe where observers have the best place for observing, our Earth is it. This suggests purpose. We were placed here to observe something. We were placed here by a designer. Why? According to the Bible, it's because he wants us to see his glory. Psalm 19 says that. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge. Psalm 19, 1 to 4. I already read that. This is the sort of universe that an intelligent agent would have some interest in designing. And why? Because he wants us to see his glory. And we're placed in the only place we could be to observe that in the Milky Way galaxy. Okay, I think we need to sing in conclusion. Let's stand up here. Talk about why God designed the universe for man. What is our role in the scheme of things? Why are we here? So I'll see you tomorrow afternoon. What is it, 3 o'clock? Yes. Okay, see you then.